session number 23787, Reel 8.
Major Dillon, Reel 8. Now, you were just saying that he was intent on getting back to the homeland, and then he made another point, didn't he, the German officer?
His companion was a captain who hitherto had been silent, and he spoke quite good English. He said, "I came along, I wanted to meet you, Major Brown. I'm the officer that burnt your camp down a few months ago, and I thought you might like to know. I stayed up in the mountains for a fortnight trying to catch you. Very pleased to meet you." I said, "You know, have a cigarette." So that was that. Then we parted company.
And you said the point that you haven't made yet is about that they'd spotted about you being afraid of the ELAS, which is why you wanted
to
explain it.
Well, the political situation in Greece was very tricky. The Allies wanted to bring the king back and a right-wing government, but the locals, particularly the ELAS, had no such idea. They wanted to take the country over themselves. So there was this possibility which ended up inevitably in the Civil War.
And you said the Germans had spotted you, but not on tape. The German officer said something to you about this. Could you just...
Well, they knew about the political situation, because they'd exacerbated it, as far as one gathers, because they knew it would inconvenience us.
But he asked you straight out, didn't he?
Oh, yes. "Are you afraid of your communist allies?" And I evaded the subject. I said, "Oh, no. You know, really, seeing you, it might be better if you stayed here and surrendered rather than..." I said, "It's a very long way back to Germany. You've got to get across Yugoslavia and all that." Anyway, he decided to take his chance.
And that was the last meeting you had with him, was it?
Yes. Then the thing is important. Because I'd been away, and I knew things were... We were expecting a drop from Cairo with people. I rode all night under a moon and got back to camp to find that the most ghastly thing had happened. A Dakota circling the dropping zone, which Sergeant Dick, the New Zealander, had taken, had dropped its load of containers, and then the passengers were due to drop. The thing crashed, they were all killed, the whole lot, the crew, the passengers, the lot. And that was really probably the low point of the whole operation, I think. These reinforcements, all killed, the German not doing, one was wondering what the LS were going to do and so on.
Now, you still did get three new reinforcements.
A bit later came another drop containing Stanley Legg, Lieutenant Legg RE, and Flight Lieutenant Darlow, and Corporal Deeth, radio operator.
Now, can we talk about this? Because, well, certainly Legg's quite an important figure.
He's very important. I've got a whole story about him.
What was he like?
Legg was, he was a Dorset farming stock with a rrr, you know, very stocky, tough, very resolute, very resilient, obviously hand-picked chap for the job.
And what was his mission?
His mission was to reconnoitre the three main Athens airfields, Elefsis, Hassani, and Tatoi, with a view to selecting one or other of them as a dropping zone for the parachute brigade, whose mission would be the relief of Athens and securing the Piraeus docks. Accompanying him was Flight Lieutenant Darlow, the meteorological officer, whose mission was to send out accurate weather reports for the airborne landing.
And Corporal Death.
Corporal Deeth. Deeth was a radio, Royal Corps Signals radio operator. Had his own setup.
Now, how did you help? Your orders were to provide backup.
Maximum backup. Well, he needed everything. He needed transport, mules to carry, because the radios and the charging and all is heavy, and kit. Mules, an interpreter. Basically, that's what he needed. And a couple of guides, you know, local local chaps who knew the way about. He was quite a... Sorry, I'm like... So he was quite a small party. He didn't need to be a big party. And he established himself above Elefsis, within sight of the airfield.
And what about the Flight Lieutenant Darlow?
Flight Lieutenant Darlow was the mess officer. George Astras, my interpreter, had a friend who was the director of the Greek Athens Observatory, which was run overseen by the Germans. He infiltrated Darlow into the German observatory, where he sat down in the ground floor office receiving the bottom copy of the German Met reports, which he sent by runner back to Deeth, who sent it back to Cairo. So they got it.
Now, what you moved near to Athens as well, or nearer?
A bit later, because right. Then more things started to arrive.
What else was coming in then?
First of all appeared a chap calling himself Major Parks, a bearded individual, who I was very suspicious of.
Why were you suspicious of?
The Germans were always trying to infiltrate us. They would send up German-speaking so-called deserters, who in fact spoke English, who would try to pretend and all that. We had to shoot one in Kiriaki, actually. We rumbled him.
And who was this Major Parks? Was he genuine or
what? He turned out to be absolutely genuine. He was, in fact, in charge of A-Force escape organization. And his name, actually, you may have heard of. He was head of A-Force in Frank McGaskey, MC in two bars.
So Major Parks was Frank McGaskey?
Yes, but nobody told me, of course, and he didn't tell me anything. And I said, whoever you might be behind that beard, I don't know you. You're not prepared to tell me. You do not leave this camp without my permission. He said, understood. I said, I'm sending a signal to find out who you are. So he came back. He arrived, and then another fellow called Dodson arrived, who was a bloody nuisance, but I better not say too much about him. He was a fool.
Why is that?
Well, he let me down. No, I think I better.
Okay,
I put a bit in the book, but I think I better leave it out. He's still with us.
And what happened next, then?
And then other people, there was a Colonel Setchell, United States Air Force, who was most impressed with our setup. He said, gee, nobody told me anything about this. All them pilots, they get back. I got something to say about this. He'd managed to land his Lightning aircraft in a valley. He'd been damaged, and he brought the bloody thing down and stepped out of it. And he said, do you mean... you could have a cup of tea or a whiskey, and I'm afraid we haven't got any soda, we got water. Gee, God damn it! You mean you got a cup of tea? I said, yeah, we'd have coffee if you like. But he was... he was a great chap. They couldn't get it. They said, nobody told us nothing about it. I said, of course they didn't. We didn't want people to know. Fewer people know about it, the better.
So what happened next, then?
Then the time came to move. The LS were moving, and I decided, now that Parks had disclosed himself as McGaskey, we both teamed up and agreed that the biggest danger would be trouble in Athens if there weren't any British troops there. Before any British troops might arrive, it would be a good idea if we arrived in uniform. So I agreed to go down with the LS division that was moving towards Athens, and he went down. He was a friend of Damaskinos, who became regent. Remember Damaskinos, who'd sheltered him when he was an escaped prisoner. He said, I'll go down and rouse Damaskinos, because he's a sort of father figure of Greece, and he can perhaps pour oil on troubled waters. So we went our separate ways, and I got on my horse and rode down with the Elas. And then the story goes on from there, that the parachute brigade, George Jellicoe had landed at Patras and unannounced had got himself, he was told just to take the airfield there, he'd got himself as far as Corinth and decided to go for Athens. Well, the Germans had anticipated our attack would come from Italy up the Gulf of Corinth, so their rear guard was to the east of the main road and rail, facing west. Or to the west of the main road, facing west. And Jellicoe bumped up against his doink. You get no further now, whoever you might be. So the powers that be in Athens, instead of proceeding with the drop as arranged on one of the Athens airfields, dropped the parachute brigade at Megara in half a gale of wind and the wrong side of the German rearguard, which, I mean, I cry to this day.
Now, you'd warn them of this?
I had no idea. Megara had never ever been mentioned. It was a remote auxiliary airstrip, miles from Athens. It never entered our... Since we reconnoitred the three main airfields, which are all good dropping zones, wide open, proper airfields. And that was the most ghastly tragedy. And I've never... And Legg, when he, after the war, spent months at Kew trying to find out who gave that order. We never did discover who gave the order. So it meant that Athens was not occupied properly. And then the story goes on. I was sent down to, with the Greek Katsotis, who was from the Greek government, to try and get the LS to attack the German. There was a German demolition party of about 150 strong to stop them. And I sent a note saying, I offer you safe conduct back to Megara, provided you desist from blowing the docks. And he, two fingers up, they did it. And we sat in the police station while this went on. But they did, however, defend the power station, which was not blown up. As I put in my story, the reason they did that, most of them worked there. But they could have saved the docks quite easily if they'd gone in. But who were we? We were three of us, George Strauss, myself, armed with a pistol. And no, I don't think I think we were unarmed. I think we were in civilian clothes. I don't think we could have done it. There's nothing we could do. Except issue threats, we say. And that was that. That was a...
And that was the situation.
So that was a situation. And then Athens was eventually so-called occupied by the British. The parachute brigade eventually got through and the Germans withdrew. And for about a month, there was absolute... Hey ho, and the wine flowed, and the girls did what girls do, and everybody was terribly happy. And then the Civil War started, which is a whole new ball game, the revolution.
Well, tell us about how that started. As far as, I mean, what you could see it coming.
Well, a lot of us could see it coming. I mean, Caro, for want of a better word, had been warned what the communists. I say LS, they were the soldiers, the Communist Party that controlled it, were up to, was the occupation of Athens and the control of the country. And as with that in mind, we were trying, as I said, Parks and myself, or rather McGaskey and myself, were trying to do what we could. He was doing it through Damaskinos. I thought, well, I got Orestes, who is the leader of the LS, one of his pictures up there. I'll take him to see the Greek government established itself by now in the parliament in Athens. General Spiridopoulos, who'd been appointed pro tem governor, acting prime minister. I went in and I had one of those ridiculous interviews. In comes Orestes with his bodyguard of tough bandits. And there's Spiridopoulos sitting behind a huge desk. It started off by Spiridopoulos saying, I don't recognize you, Orestes, as being a general. And Orestes said, I'm not a general, I'm a capitanus, I'm a synagonist, a comrade. But I don't recognize you as a soldier, I don't remember you at the Greek Staff College. He said, no, general, when you were at the Greek Staff College, I was a steward in a ship. But Orestes, who had a lovely sense of humor, said, however, the difference between you is, you have about 3,000 men of the Greek brigade under your command, I have 25,000 well-armed men who are already in Athens. So shouldn't we talk business? I don't want to talk to you. I have nothing to do with you. So that was the end of that.
Whose side did you take in the interview? I mean,
I was myself, if you like. I mean, I was trying to press Spiridopoulos to negotiate, to bend a bit.
How do you spell Spiridopoulos? Sorry.
Spiridopoulos. S-P-I-L-O-T-O-P-O-L-O-S.
And Orestes' name was...
Mundricus. Now, Miriam's not in the room. Do you know what Mundricus means? The children, they used to say, what's this Mundricus? It's a female pubic hair. Muni is a female organ. Trica is a hair. So it's a race. What that's worth. That's not on the tape, is it?
General Orestes, and I mean, from what they were saying, you describe the conversation, it seems somewhat more sympathetic to Orestes.
I was, I think, because I didn't know Spilotopoulos.
Had he been engaged in any partisan activities or any...
Who? Spilotopoulos had come from Cairo. He'd come in from...
He hadn't been involved?
Anything at all, no. His knees weren't brown, as they used to say in the desert. He was just sitting there. And Orestes was a very likeable chap I tried always saying, well, you Greeks, you must do what you like. It's your country. And we warned Cairo, all of us, that the Greeks didn't want the king back. They wanted a republic. They are republicans. And I could never understand how it was in Yugoslavia, the next country up the road, we backed Tito, didn't we? Got rid of Mikhailovich. In Greece, we got rid of the ELAS and backed the king. And I asked a Foreign Office friend once, he said, of course, you don't understand, old boy. I said, I know I don't bloody understand. I'm just but a simple soldier. You politicians confuse me. Absolutely. One decision must have been wrong. When you think about it, a bit of an oversimplification, but so.
Now, so what was your position once how did the Civil War start?
The Civil War, so I had an agent, I seem to have endless agents, who was a minor official on the AAM, which is the political wing of ELAS, Central Committee in Athens. And he came to me and said, they are going to start an attack. He gave a date and a time, and the signal will be the ringing of the church bells. So I went to see General Scobie's chief of staff and told him all this. And he looked at me and said, of course, Dylan, you must be very tired. You've been here a very long time. I think you're probably exaggerating. I think perhaps you should have a month's leave. I said, well, sir, I'm telling you that's what's going to happen. And it did. And he said, in any case, there are only a lot of hairy-ass bandits. You know we've got a squadron of Sherman tanks. That'll soon put the right. I said, the Germans had two armored divisions here and three infantry divisions. They weren't frightened of that. So I said, they're not whatever else, they may be hairy-ass got beards. I said, they don't frighten. I can assure you of that. So anyway, the die was cast, and it started.
How did it start?
It started, it's very difficult to know how it started. There was a parade, a civilian parade, they say, of banners, ELAS, ELAS, Zeta, hooray for the Kappa, Kappa, Epsilon, all that kind of stuff, down the main drag. There were police, so-called, organizing, I think. Somebody fired a shot. Who fired the first shot? I don't know. Anyway, there were about 20 civilians were killed or wounded, and there was shooting, and that was the start of it. I think it was the communists deliberately dragging their coats. They wanted the shooting to start. They may well have opened fire first in order to stage an incident. And then it started, very seriously, and we were very nearly driven out of Athens.
What happened? What were you doing? Where were you stationed at the time?
Well, I was in a house in Athens and had... I had an advantage being an SOE as opposed to, I lived, as it were, a civilian in a flat. I wasn't in any kind of military formation. And I kept in touch with ELAS headquarters on the telephone throughout the thing and passed signals, and which I've got copies of. But nobody took any notice at all. And eventually, one of Orestes' staff officers came over and joined us, and he brought their order of battle and said, I'm tired of this, we must have. And then I got on to Orestes. He said, you must tell your generals to stop shooting. They must stop bombing us. And I said, I can't tell them. Why don't you get... Anyway, it was all an awful kind of shambolic business at the end. Dick Turner, who we've heard of before, who was the escaped Australian soldier who joined us and stayed right through. He could have been evacuated any time. He volunteered to stay right to the end. it's now getting towards Christmas, and I said, Dick, there's nothing more for you to do. Would you like to get, we could get you home for Christmas? And he agreed. He handed in his kit, got on a truck to go down to the airfield, was ambushed on the way down, he was shot through the head. And I had to write to his widow, and he'd survived everything until then. That was Dick Turner.
What was the scale of the fighting going on?
Considerable.
What did you see of it? I mean, were you involved at all?
Not as fighting, but driving about involved in it, yes. And I didn't command anything. I was still a so-called agent trying to find out what was going on and pass information, which is all there somewhere. But
so you weren't, you were sort of still, in a sense, in SOE.
I still SOE, that's right. Oh, yes, that's right. And by then I'd met Miriam, who was MI6.
Now, could you explain how you met, because it seemed to be you were to marry. This is Miriam Preston.
Miriam Preston, who'd been educated at the German school in Athens. Her best friend was Nicky Rallis, whose father was the Quisling Prime Minister. And how he came to meet her, long before I met Miriam, it was suggested that Nicky Rallis's daughter, John Rallis's daughter, Nicky, had left-wing leanings in view of her position as his hostess, because he was estranged from his wife. She might be a useful contact. So Harry McIntyre was dispatched to make contact with Nicky, which he duly did, and ended up marrying her. And a signal came, this liaison is far too dangerous, sever all contact with Rallis. All contact must, and I sent a signal back, too late, contact has been made. And she introduced me to Miriam during the height of all this uproar. And we got married. So we
at the time? You got married straight away? Or?
No, we came out, actually, and had a joint wedding in Cairo. I mean, Harry had been through a form of wedding during the occupation, but we had a proper blown-up wedding in Cairo Cathedral, actually, a big sort of do, and lived happily ever. Sadly, Harry McIntyre died, but Nicky was here the other day for Miriam's 80th birthday, alive and well and full of beans. And
Had you actually met Miriam during the actual
During the Civil War, yes.
During the Civil War, during the
No, because she was in Cairo. She came back with the Liberation Force, with the embassy, in fact.
Now, what happened in the fighting? I mean, were you aware of what was going on?
Well, very much, and one was continually being a messenger between the French head people and civilians, and trying to get messages from the Red Cross and all that sort of stuff. And the RAF headquarters out in the suburbs was overrun, and they took, I think, 240 prisoners, and they were marched up into the mountains, and I used to try and send signals to see if they were all right and so on.
And, I mean, the scale of the fight, I know the 16th Durham Light Infantry, they brought in some of the 46th Division.
That's right, they brought in, 4th Indian came, and 46 British Division, 2 divisions came. So it was fairly serious stuff.
And what happened with the negotiations with ELAS? Because they took some SAS men, didn't they? And
that's right, yes. I actually was a go-between, because they'd contacted me, go-between, to release them. I remember saying they were vital technical troops required to repair the pumping station, which was a complete lie, of course.
How did the negotiations go?
Well, mostly they went there, and I remained on good terms.
No, I mean over getting the prisoners out.
We got released. Those released. Eventually, they were all released. But horrendous massacres of civilians went on. In fact, I don't think any British soldiers were executed, but a lot of Greek civilians were, which was really not my.
So when did you become aware that ELAS were being defeated? Because in the end they were defeated.
They were defeated. They started withdrawing from Athens, and by that time, had I gone out to Cairo, I can't remember, I think, yes, I'd.
When did you leave?
Was it January, Feb?
Well, you were married in February, so.
So it must have been the beginning of February. We'd have got married more
but
or less.
But you weren't involved in the final negotiations?
No. It was far above me. I mean, I was just... And what was manifestly obvious, the authorities, the powers would be, wanted nothing to do with SOE. A friend of mine who was on the police mission had been in the desert with me, and he had been wounded, so he was on light duty, was attached to the police mission. He said at a conference with Brigadier Springhall, who was the chief of staff, he said, anybody present, this is top confidential meeting, what we're going on next is Athens. I understand it's a fine city. We all should, this is before he knew anything about civil war, we should all have a jolly good time, but we must make quite sure that those SOE fellows don't get involved with us. They know far too much. So that was the attitude of the authorities to SOE. Let's get rid of them, the sooner the better, because they know too much.
Did you feel that the whole thing could have been prevented then?
I'm not sure if it could have been prevented. It possibly could have been. If the ELAS had, for instance, one could have given them orders, we could have gone to Orestes or somebody could have said, look, there's still Germans in Crete. Here's a ship. Would you like to go over there and fight them? Or there were, I believe, quite a lot. But we were supremely arrogant. And I say we, the Scobie and his staff and the government were arrogant. They said, you know, we're bringing the king back, we don't give a bugger. They did have a plebiscite, basically, before the king, but the intention was there all the time. If they'd temporized, if they'd said, let's have an interim republic or something and then see, it, who knows what might have happened, ifs and ands.
Now, what about your recall? And how were you recalled?
What to?
To Egypt, to Cairo.
Well, it was end of time, really, more nothing to do. It was time to go, boy. And you're wanted back in Cairo to finalise the report. We sat there filling in reports, and SOE was wound up as an organisation in Greece. It's gone, finished. Everybody, all SOE was drawn.
And what happened when you got to Cairo? What was the debriefing process like?
It was very thorough, actually. We even had to be psychoanalyzed.
Well, what was that like?
Well, one chap who sadly got killed later on, he took it all as a bit of a joke, pretended he got a dog on a lead and trying. It was a lady trick cyclist, took the piss out. I said, you're very naughty, she's only trying to help. Now, they were generally concerned that we'd been under considerable pressure for some time, and it was part of the debriefing process.
And what sort of symptoms were they looking for?
I don't know. I said, I'm all right. I'm about to get married. I'm very happy. You know, I think this, what do they call it, post-traumatic shock is a new word they've invented since then. I think then you would just tell to get on. It was a report to Sergeant Major, he'd tell you what to do, you know.